You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up on Set List, we'll hear from a folk singer who will tell us how he went from playing heavy metal songs in a garage to writing the heartfelt folk songs he's made a living on.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. A new challenge in Medicaid may help close the health gap that many Native Americans face. And it was recently reported that the state's Government Accountability Board didn't spend anything on outside investigations over the past 2 years.
Robert Menser joins us now for the latest on those stories and more. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network, Wisconsin, and he's based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So let's start with that Native American health gap. How serious is it?
So it's pretty serious. And I mean, it's a complicated issue, and there are a lot of causes. There's a lot of the causes have their root in sort of economic deficits between the Native American community and sort of the white community or Wisconsin, the average Wisconsin median income. But it's pretty serious. There a report by the Wisconsin Council on Children and Families released in May found that Native American babies are 69% more likely to die within their first year, and Native Americans in Wisconsin have an average life expectancy of 63 years compared to 77 years for whites.
Wow, that is very significant.
It's stark.
So what's this change in Medicaid that may help with that?
So this is a change to federal Medicaid reimbursement policies. So obviously this sounds like we're pretty deep into policy weeds, but there are people who think this is going to make a difference. Basically what it is this. There are health clinics that serve Native communities in Wisconsin, and they provide more than just only direct doctor care. They maybe offer transportation services, or they do long-term care for people who are in their homes, or they have education programs, nutrition programs. The old policy was that the federal government would pay 60% of the costs for these specialized programs. The state was supposed to pay 40%, and what happens in these cases is it creates fights about exactly what is counted and what the exact reimbursement rate is going to be, and as we have seen in Wisconsin, the state also can make changes to its own Medicaid policy. So the new policy, the feds are going to pay 100% of the costs of these specialty care programs for Native communities. So the hope is that this will allow them to expand. It'll be more security for these programs and allow maybe more access to care in some of these communities.
My understanding is that also it says that it's not just limited to care provided within the confines of a clinic, but also basically clinic overseen programs that are out in the community. So it seems like especially for Native Americans who are living outside of more urban settings, that maybe this will also increase access.
100%, and that's where, and I mean, it's easy to understand, right? That's where, for instance, these transportation programs might have the most effect, is in rural areas and less densely populated areas. But yeah, there are a number of, I think that healthcare in general is coming around and is continuing to move toward a more sort of holistic model, right? You're supposed to look at not just the specific symptoms, but the broader conditions that are affecting a patient's health. And so that's the idea here, is to promote that type of program that is more takes a broader look and can address some of the factors that are contributing to people's health problems as well.
So Governor Walker had decided not to accept the expansion possibilities of Medicare and Medicaid funds under the Affordable Care Act. Does that have any role in these changes not having happened sooner?
So I think that it's not exactly direct, but it is certainly related. So this is all under the umbrella of Medicaid, and in Wisconsin, of course, Medicaid program is called Badger Care, administered by the state. And for sure, the fact that Wisconsin chose not to accept the Obamacare Medicaid expansion put pressure on that program. There also were a bunch of changes to who is eligible for Medicaid. In some cases, dropping the eligibility down to the, in Wisconsin, dropping eligibility down to the poverty line. Those changes combined for sure change who could get Medicaid in Wisconsin and what sorts of services are provided.
Rob, let's move on to the Government Accountability Board. It turns out that Wisconsin's Government Ethics and Elections Watchdog Authority didn't spend anything on hiring outside investigators for the past 2 years. Is that significant?
It feels pretty significant. $0 in 2 years. I mean, I guess it's possible that all of our politicians just did nothing wrong in that time, but it feels like, wait a minute. So it's a big drop, and the key of the drop is they were spending about $45,000 in election years, according to the report in the Wisconsin State Journal, during the John Doe investigation, specifically that applied to campaign activities by Governor Scott Walker's campaigns. That jumped up to close to $200,000 in a year. This doesn't mean that there were literally no investigations in these last 2 years. This is no payment for outside investigations. Mm-hmm. So a spokesman for the Government Accountability Board said that the board chose not to hire investigators because staff, quote, had sufficient time to conduct the investigations and the cases did not require extensive field work. So, okay, so they're doing their job. But, of course, another explanation, and one that that was advanced by some good government types, is that what was happening is they were under heavy scrutiny. They were under political pressure because this is the exact time when Republicans in the legislature were drumming up calls to ultimately what they did, which was to split the GAB and do away with the agency.
So as you just referenced, the nonpartisan GAB is winding down in its mandate, and it's been replaced with two new committees that are staffed by political appointees, both major parties being able to appoint people to work on those. So is there anything that should be learned or applied from the findings about those, that lack of bringing in outside investigators?
Well, I mean, I think that there are certainly going to be some of those appointees are going to sort of read the tea leaves on that, right? What has happened in the state, they've split the Government Accountability Board into an elections board and an ethics board, separate boards. This is, of course, the way that it was before the creation of the Government Accountability Board in 2007. I think everyone basically unanimously agrees that as separate boards, there's going to be less power, less investigation power in these agencies. One thing they did that didn't used to be the case is the Republicans in the legislature set a cap on how much the new state elections and ethics commissions can spend on these outside investigations. They set that at $250,000, which is, I mean, I guess it's worth saying is that's less than what they were spending in the John Doe days. But it used to be that there was no cap at all, and their mandate was to follow the investigations where they led in order to, you know, root out public corruption. And I think, there's a concern that they will be less able to do that in the future.
And finally, Rob, as we wrap up quickly, a new Marquette Law School poll came out on Wednesday, and Governor Scott Walker's approval rating is going down. And how did he react to that?
Yeah, he knows why. He did what a lot of politicians like to do when things are not going their way, which is blame the news media. So Governor Walker said on a call with reporters this week that the headlines are always negative and bad things, so it's no wonder that people feel that way. His own approval rating is back down in the 30s, 39%, but also he was also responding to, maybe even more so, responding to respondents' answers that they have a negative view overall of the direction the state is heading in, and they say that the budget is not as well off as it was a few years ago.
And we'll have to leave it there, Rob. Thanks so much for joining us. That was editor Rob Menser joining us to recap the biggest news stories from around the state this week.
Coming up, it's Set List with Duluth folk singer Charlie Parr. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, every U.S. president has been a father in one way or another. We'll learn about how being a parent went hand-in-hand with being a political leader.
First, we continue our summer music series. On Set List, we invite artists from all over the Midwest into the WPR studios for interviews and exclusive musical performances, which air every Friday at this time through Labor Day weekend.
Today, we feature Duluth, Minnesota's Charlie Parr. Armed with a 12-string guitar and a dobro, Parr recently stopped by the WPR studio to talk with host Rob Ferret, play a few songs, and reveal how he went from playing Black Sabbath covers in a garage to writing the heartfelt folk songs he's making a living on today.
Charlie, thanks for playing for us in the studio.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, I want to go back to the beginning. What first drew you to pick up a guitar?
Well, my dad's record collection, and it was pretty eclectic. It went from, you know, Johnny Cash and Johnny Horton all the way back down to Woody Guthrie and Leadbelly, and like, it was a mess. There wasn't a lot of labels on stuff. But two of the records that actually had covers were a Lightnin' Hopkins record called Blues in the Bottle and a Mance Lipscomb record, the first Texas Songster record. And I was obsessed. I was 7.5 years old, I think, when I finally figured out that these records were what they were, and I played them all the time. And I told my dad I wanted to play the guitar. And, you know, he did a little horse trading with some junk and ended up with a really pretty nice Gibson B25 12-string that I took 6 of the strings off, first of all, because I didn't 12-string. I had no clue. And I would just sit and try to play along with those records. And so understanding how it was happening was a complete mystery. So I just made up a way it could happen for me, which much later in my life, someone in the world had filmed Mance Lipscomb playing, and I got to see it like 5 years ago now. I was totally flabbergasted. I'd gotten it all wrong, you know, and I'd been getting it all wrong for decades.
You taught yourself in a way, and you learned at the feet of Lightnin' Hopkins and Leadbelly, and yet you were putting together your own method to play what they played, I guess.
Right. I mean, there's certain sounds that I wanted so bad, and I found a way to get there. I mean, I moved to the Minneapolis in the early 80s, you know, and I'd go down and see Willie Murphy every Friday and Spider John Kerner every Sunday and Dave Ray every Thursday, and just like probably creep these guys out really bad because I'm sitting like feet away from them, just wide-eyed looking at everything they did. And
learning everything you can.
Trying to learn everything I could. So, you know, in a way I was kind of self-taught, and in another much larger way I'm not at all self-taught, you know.
Have I lived my whole life for it to come down to this? Remember me if I forget. My eyesight is sharp, but I don't know your face. Remember me if I forget. Remember me if I forget. Remember me.
I wonder, you play solo usually. I know on the new album you have a band with you some, but given that you figured out your style on your own, was it weird the first time you started playing with other people? Was it a translation process?
It still is.
Really?
I still don't know a lot of the lingo and the names of things. Mathematics are involved when someone says, hey, go to the 5, and I'm like... I don't know what you're talking about, but you don't want to say that because you look like an idiot, so you kind of just, I did this one? You know, so, and I don't play with people that often, so it's usually not a problem. I mean, I remember when I was young, and some friends of mine had kind of a garage band, and they saw I had a guitar, so, like, you should be in our band, uh-huh. And I'm like, it's a acoustic 12-string, you know, and they're playing Sabbath covers, and, like, you know, and don't get me wrong, I like Black Sabbath a lot, but I've also been real singular about what it is that I want to play and the sounds I want to make, you know, and that's what I've done, and I've not really strayed much from that.
I want to get into your songwriting. When I hear Remember Me If I Forget and Over the Red Cedar, I almost felt like I just met somebody, not you, but like there's a character coming through the song.
Oh, thank you.
Do you start with a person and start telling, I don't know, their words or building a story around them? How does that work?
Well, I think when I first started, I didn't start writing songs until 1995 or 96 after my dad had passed away. Before then, it was just like trying to make my own versions of the old songs. And then I started writing songs, and my process for writing songs has really been to write stories and then disassemble the stories and reassemble them into songs, because the stories are horrible and no one would want to read that song.
Well, the kids are getting bigger. They can't play outside like it used to be. You know exactly what's lurking out there. You can see it on the news every night. And the village that it takes to raise our kids is afraid to come outside. And the red cedar grows and the red cedar flows. And long after you're gone, it's outlasting you. Outlasting you. Outlasting you. It's outlasting you.
How do you know when you're done writing a song? How do you know when it's performance ready, or do you take it on the road and keep tweaking it?
Yeah, it's not done. It's never done. None of them have been done. There are two songs that I wrote that I think are done, and I haven't played them since they were finished. So, you know, it feels like when a song is really going well, it feels like it's organic. Like Over the Red Cedar started out as this really slow, dirgy ballad, and it just never felt right. It never got played. But I liked it enough to keep messing with it until I kind of rearranged it as what it is. And then it felt like it was ready to go, and then I started performing it. It still doesn't really feel done. I mean, I'm messing with it, I think.
Well, here's where it gets tricky, though. You've got a CD out, a stump jumper, a producer, a band, and you had to lock in on a finished version. I mean, obviously, you can still play it differently live whenever you want to, but at some point, you had to lock something in that's going to be the version that people hear. What's that like to say, okay, that's the one we're committing to posterity for now?
That was for me, that was one of my most favorite experiences that I've had in the last few years playing music, was Phil Cook, the producer and a good friend of mine. You know, he had access to this farm in Hillsboro, and he said he had some friends that would play, and I'm like, I'm nervous about playing with people because I'm not kind of that kind of player, but I trust Phil, and I rolled up on this place. And we sat down, and I started playing the songs, and I left for Knoxville the next day with the record done.
Wow.
I credit most of this to Phil because he had the glow on him or something. It just, everything fell into place. Everything worked really well. The other guys, music is funny because you can meet someone for the first time and sit down and play three songs with them and feel like you've known them for all of your life, you know. And that's how it was with these guys. I sat in this room and we played my songs. They're personal and, you know, sometimes a little hairy. And at the end of the day, I felt like I'd grown up with them all, you know.
Does that make you want to collaborate more? Maybe tour with more than just you?
Sometimes, yeah. I was super happy for that experience, and if another experience like that comes up, I'm going to be ready for it.
Somebody going to tell me what I'm doing here. Ain't somebody going to tell me where I'm gone. Ain't somebody going to spend a blank minute on me. Won't you pray for an old hobo who's gone wrong?
Talk to you about touring, because you play a lot of shows, and you drive a lot.
It's now it feels more natural for me to be doing that than it does to do anything else. Last year, I think I put in 250 dates, and, you know, the car sometimes doesn't start, and sometimes the front doors won't open now. But if you park it on a hill, you can always climb in the back door, and if I can get it rolling, I can
push
the clutch and get the thing started again, but...
And the car isn't just your transportation. I understand it's your grill, too.
It's everything. It's my bed. It's my stove. You know, I've got a little wire harness on the exhaust manifold. It's kind of a single-serving engine. It's real small. You know, the exhaust manifold's maybe 6 inches long. But you can get a package of beans on there and, you know, 25, 30 miles in nice weather will have you dinner.
Now, they say big in Japan for the heavy metal bands. You're big in Australia. How did that happen?
I'm not actually big in Australia.
Well, that's not what our producers told me.
But, Australia's amazing. It reminds me, besides the 16-hour flight, it reminds me of just, like, touring in Montana. You know, everybody's super friendly. It's easy to get around. You know, I think I do about the same there as I do anyplace else. But just kind of getting to go there and get to play music there is pretty dear. So I'm very grateful for it.
Speaking of international attention, I guess some French filmmakers made a documentary about you a few years ago. How did that come to pass, or what was that like?
Yeah, that's weird. I met those guys in Sydney, Australia, at a show, and we hit it off, and I made some joke about, yeah, if you're ever in Minnesota, you know, come up, we'll hang out. Oh yeah, you know, going to do that. And sure enough, like 9 months later, they called me up and said, we're going to make a film about you. Like, you are crazy, but bring it on. And they came over and they made this documentary, which was extremely flattering. My mother, you know, my poor mother's kind of humble, like Depression-era folks almost always are. And she tried to watch that, and she was just mortified. Everybody's saying such nice things about me. I told the French guys, too. I said, you should go across the street and interview the guy across the street, because he hates my guts. He hates everything about me. And you just go over and mention my name to him and see what you get. And they're like, I don't want to talk to that guy. But they wouldn't do it. So it was very flattering, but it's also a really pretty weird feeling.
Ain't somebody gonna spend a blank minute on me? Won't you pray for an old hobo who's gone home?
Now, you're from Austin, Minnesota. You're in Duluth now. You're a child of the upper Midwest. How does that inform your music?
The changes in the weather and the way that seasons change up there. The seasonal changes in northern Minnesota are aggressive, you know. The scenery up there, the difference between the expansiveness of Lake Superior, which I can walk to in 4 blocks from where I live in Duluth, and you can just walk 4 blocks in another direction and suddenly you're in the forest and you can't see a house anywhere. So, and all that stuff seems to like feed into the music somehow.
So you've got the new album out, Stump Jumper. You've got touring, another trip to Australia. What else? You've got a lot on your plate already.
I'll be in August. I'll be in Sweden, the UK, Israel, and in Ireland, and then come back home and do some touring in the fall. And then I really hope to do another recording over the next winter if I'm still able.
But the key is you're up in front of people making music.
Yeah, you know, I want to do that, and I'm grateful to be able to do that. I'm going to play as long as my hands will let me, no matter who's listening, but I just want to play guitar.
Charlie, thanks a lot for joining us in the studio.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
That was Duluth, Minnesota's Charlie Parr. You can catch him live June 24th at the Edgewater in Madison.
Setlist Summer Music Series airs every Friday at this time through Labor Day weekend. Support comes from Hyde Music. For more about the artists featured on Setlist, including songs and videos of their exclusive performances at our WPR studio, head over to wpr.org/setlist.
I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. You're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up tonight at 7, it's Ken Rudin's Political Junkie. Tonight, the horror of the terrorist attacks in Orlando has led to the inevitable finger-pointing and partisan political rhetoric. Elizabeth Zuckmeister, a political science professor at Vanderbilt University, talks about how Republicans and male candidates often benefit. That's tonight at 7 on Ken Rudin's Political Junkie.
First, for the men who have ultimately become president, they have one crucial factor in common. They're all fathers, either biologically or through adoption.
And according to our next guest, their time in the Oval Office with their children in tow can say a lot about how the president approaches governance at home and nationwide.
Joshua Kendall is with us now to look at presidential fathers at the start of this Father's Day weekend. He's the author of First Dads, Parenting and Politics from George Washington to Barack Obama. Joshua, welcome to Central Time.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
What made you want to look at this particular relationship between fathers, and it is fathers at this point, all fathers and their children?
My last book was called America's Obsessives, and I profiled 7 American icons who were control freaks. And I started with Thomas Jefferson. I did Henry Heinz, the ketchup guy, and Steve Jobs. And in my Jefferson chapter, I learned that there was a disconnect between how he led the country and how he led the family. He was an amazing leader. He's elected by 75% of the vote in 1804. But as a dad, he was a control freak, and he made life difficult for his daughters. He told them what to do, what to wear. He made lists for them. And then that just brought up the whole question about how one leads a family and what skills are involved in that and whether those are the same skills with leading a country. Often I did find that the private and the public man was different. Franklin Roosevelt and Ronald Reagan were both great communicators with the nation, but they couldn't communicate so well with their own children. But sometimes the dad and the president are the same. John Adams, I call him a tiger dad. He was very tough with his kids, and he was also tough with the nation. He gave us the Alien and Sedition Acts. And sometimes dads are sweet with their kids and also try to connect with their nation. Our current president, Barack Obama, falls into that category, as does Harry Truman and James Monroe, the author of The Era of Good Feeling, back in the early 19th century.
It's a fascinating area to look at, and you argue that, you know, these days we boil down presidential character or fitness to whether or not a president has been faithful or has had any extramarital affairs, and you say that this is actually another pretty rich vein to look at when you really want to understand someone and their character.
Right, because children are sort of more help, you know, especially today, women have a lot more power, and they can do what they want, and it's sort of It's a meter of how the president deals with people without a lot of power. And I just found the one touching scene, James Garfield, not a very well-known president, our 20th president, was very concerned about the rights of blacks after the Civil War, and he's assassinated in 1881. But he also was such a sweet dad, and the two kind of went together, you know, blacks in that era. Were, you know, it was just after slavery, and they had absolutely no power. And Garfield, you know, really wanted to help them. And it's so sad because then Jim Crow comes in. But he also was very sensitive to his adolescent kids. One of them was having a romantic relationship, and his wife was very nervous. And Garfield, you know, really understood the kid and said, you know, nothing to worry about. This is just part of growing up. And just that connection and how they experience connection really tells you a lot about how they're going to view some larger issues.
Right, and you break it down into three different types of presidential dads. There's the authoritarian, not to be confused with the authoritative, and then the preoccupied dad. Can you tell us just an overview of who you found in some of those categories?
Yeah, the most common category is the preoccupied. These were men who were thinking about obtaining and using power all the time. LBJ famously said, "I think about politics only 18 hours a day." And so he really didn't have much time for his daughters, and his daughters really liked him and wanted to spend more time with him. So Lyndon, as a teenager, Lyndon Johnson, his elder daughter, started downing the congressional record. She figured that if she knew about legislation before Congress, her father would pay more attention to her. And another example is Jimmy Carter. We remember Amy from the 70s, but Jimmy Carter actually had three elder sons, and his son Jack said that, you know, dad is one track, you know, dad is totally driven, and that's the standard path to get to the White House, is to be preoccupied. And then the authoritative dads are the nurturing dads, and those are dads that can really negotiate with their kids. But the authoritarian kind of boss them around, and the preoccupied often are absentee dads. Richard Nixon, when he was a young senator, would sleep in his Senate office. And in 1960, he loses the election to Kennedy, and his wife says, "Okay, now you're going to have more time for me and the girls." And Nixon immediately takes on a bunch of projects, including the book Six Crises, and he's just never around for his children. So the story isn't good overall. USA Today, in its review, said father knows best, except maybe when he's president. I left a copy for President Obama when I was in Washington, and I called him, you know, one of the best first dads. But then I added, though, as you will note, the competition isn't particularly keen. And by and large, these were men who really put family life on the back burner, as you might expect, given how ambitious they were.
Well, let's talk about President Obama. He's one of your top dads, a nurturing dad, and you say he's an example of an authoritative parent, which is a good thing in your book. And here he is speaking candidly about his daughters on the show Ellen.
Both my daughters are wonderful people, and Malia is more than ready to leave, but I'm not ready for her to leave. And yeah, I was asked if I would speak at her graduation. I said, absolutely not, because I'm going to be sitting there with dark glasses, sobbing. Yeah, she's one of my best friends, and it's going to be hard for me not to have her around all the time.
Yeah, he sounds like he's all in with his daughters there. In a way, though, I mean, hasn't the notion of what a good father is, hasn't that changed over the years? In a way, is it fair to compare Barack Obama to John Adams?
Yes. The book also documents the evolution of fathering. And yes, I mean, the nurturing dad is partly a 21st century creation. But what's so interesting is that I did find some sweet dads back in the 18th century. I talked about how Thomas Jefferson was very demanding, but his fellow Virginian, James Madison, was very sweet with his two daughters, and whenever he went to Paris or went away from Virginia, he took them with him, as opposed to Jefferson. What's so interesting about Obama is that Obama never knew his own father or rarely saw his own father. He really sees him only twice. His father leaves Hawaii when Obama's a couple of months old. And then his father comes back one Christmas for a few weeks. And Obama fathers just as he was mothered. The most important influences on him developmentally were his mother and grandmother. So it's often been said that Bill Clinton is the first black president because he has a knack for connecting with African Americans and he liked to go speak in churches. But on some level, Barack Obama is kind of our first female president. I mean, emotionally, his style is he's a connector, and you could hear in that clip just how attached he is to his girls. And if you think about it, the verb fathering literally is often used just to procreate. It's not really used in terms of taking care of children, and I think that's changing. But as you say, historically, in John Adams's era, being a provider was basically all you were supposed to do. And if you were like James Monroe, that was gravy, but that wasn't part of the equation. So things are changing, and Obama is a new type of dad, but it has something to do with his own history. Another sweet dad was Rutherford B. Hayes, elected in 1876, and Hayes also never really knew his own father. In Hayes's case, his father dies a couple of months before he is born, so he too fathers as he was mothered. So Hayes was a nurturing dad, you know, back in the 19th century, and Hayes was also a Civil War general, and he was just very tender with his soldiers, and if a soldier was dying, he would make sure that his last words get sent to his lover or, you know, girlfriend or fiance or whatever, just a very sweet man. And Hayes is actually the person behind the Easter egg roll at the White House. Oh. He was very sweet to his kids and also very sweet to Washington, the kids of Washington, D.C., and one day in 1878, he's taking a walk near the White House, and a street urchin comes up to him and says, "Sir, can we roll our eggs on your lawn?" And Hayes says, you know, he loves kids, and he says, "Okay, let's do it." And today that's the biggest event in the White House every year. Some 30,000 kids show up on Obama's lawn. They now have to go through an email lottery. There's so much interest. But that was part of Hayes' sweet nature back in the 19th century.
Joshua Kendall is joining us now. He's a journalist and biographer. We're talking about his most recent book. It's called First Dads, Parenting and Politics from George Washington to Barack Obama.
And we want to hear from you. What characteristics do you think make good presidents and parents? Does it matter to you if world leaders are good parents? Or do you think presidents have to choose between ambition and being a good father? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email your comments to talk@wpr.org.
You're listening to Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation about the intersection of the presidency and parenting. And we want to hear from you. Do you think that good parents make good national leaders? Or does country trump family? Let us know what you think. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email your comments to talk@wpr.org.
We're continuing our conversation now with biographer and journalist Joshua Kendall. His new book is called First Dads, Parenting and Politics from George Washington to Barack Obama. And let's take our first caller. We've got Aaron on the line in Baraboo. Aaron, hi.
Theodore Roosevelt as a presidential dad. He was a very strong president, brought America into the imperial age, but he still seemed like a very tender, loving dad, always playing and wrestling around with his kids and playing lots of games in the White House. And want to know what your author thinks of Theodore Roosevelt as a presidential dad.
Yeah, Aaron, thank you so much for bringing that up. Because Theodore Roosevelt, I gather from your book, had a big family and also basically a menagerie living in the White House with a pony and a monkey. And he's got a pretty full family. What was he like as a father?
Yeah, actually, they had to build the West Wing, the office building in the White House, because the family quarters were so stocked with all those animals. Yeah, I describe Theodore Roosevelt as a playful pal, and as the caller says, that was the primary way that he connected with his kids, and sometimes he would stop work at 3 o'clock and go into the White House attic and play tag with one of the sons. But there's also a slightly darker side to Theodore Roosevelt as well, and that's one of the things that I try to do in this book is just capture all the sides of presidents, and that's really, you know, my job as a biographer is to capture all the sides, and Theodore Roosevelt had this really warm, fun-loving side, which was definitely a core part of him, but he also had a kind of obsession with war, because his big claim to fame was being a hero in the Spanish Civil War on San Juan Hill in 1898, and he sort of thought his sons should do the same. And when World War One comes in 1917, Theodore Roosevelt is about 55, and he's overweight, and he walks into President Wilson's office and says, I want to go lead a volunteer troop in France. And Wilson says, you're a little too old for that. But Roosevelt says, okay, my sons are going to take over for me. And he really pushes his sons to go to war. And then he gets a little bit carried away, and he wants them all to be heroes, and a couple of them get injured, and his youngest son, Quentin, dies, shot down by a pilot in 1918. And then Roosevelt really sort of catches himself in this, oh, my God, what have I done here? And it's so sad. Roosevelt dies 6 months later of a broken heart, and he was actually thinking of making a political comeback. There were no term limits in those days, and he was only about 60, and he may well have run for office in 1920 again if he hadn't died. And I also have a whole chapter on presidential grief. So just as Theodore Roosevelt didn't run for office in 1920 because of the loss of a child, these losses have affected other presidents, and also loss has affected this election. I wrote a piece for the New York Times in October about Joe Biden.
Right.
Joe Biden would have been running against Hillary Clinton this spring if he hadn't suffered a loss. So I just try to capture all the sides of family life and to show that presidents are like the rest of us and that they experience some of the same stresses.
And Joshua, just briefly, because I want to get right back to our callers, but you do say that presidential children, on a large part, seem to be kind of unlucky. It seems clear, based on your research, that this is not the easiest thing to be the kid of a president, and oftentimes they don't meet with the happiest endings.
Yes, historian Michael Beschloss has talked about the curse of the presidential child. Particularly in the 19th century, there are all kinds of tragedies. Franklin Pierce loses his third and only surviving son in a horrible train accident. Willie Lincoln dies about a decade later, Abraham Lincoln's young son. A couple of the Adams children die from alcoholism. So there's a lot of sadness, particularly in the 19th century. In the last half century, the president's children have done better. Chelsea Clinton is doing well, and the Bush twins are doing well. But in the 19th century, it used to be felt that it was a disadvantage to be the child of a president.
Let's take a caller from La Crosse now. Jeff is with us. Hi, Jeff.
Afternoon. I guess my comment is that the presidency and that job, that position, is at least a 36-hour-a-day job to begin with. And for a president to be able to make the time to be with his children, to me, is outstanding. Most business people can't do that nowadays, and to be the president and be able to do that, I think that's great.
Jeff, thanks for that. Appreciate that. So maybe a modern president should be part of the toolkit that they find time in their lives and their daily schedules to spend time with their children. Do you think, Joshua, that there's any sort of modern mental health advice to presidents to spend time with their families?
It's a very complicated and kind of gut-wrenching issue because obviously on a human level, it's extremely important both for the president and obviously for the children. But I spoke with Susan Eisenhower, Ike's granddaughter, and she said that the presidency is like a combat zone because, after all, the president is responsible for the welfare of 300 million people, and maybe on some level he has to make the sacrifice. And she said, well, maybe Obama, and she's made that argument, as have some other people, that maybe Obama is too good a father. It's not to say that it isn't terrific that he does that, but he has this tremendous responsibility. And again, it's gut-wrenching, and there are no right answers. But he's also kind of been criticized. Remember, I said that LBJ was working on politics all the time, and LBJ wouldn't have dinner with his daughters but would be twisting arms and having drinks with senators. And Obama has kind of been criticized for that. And I guess it's part of this national conversation about, what is sensible work-life balance, and arguments could be made every which way. And in my book, I just try to talk about the patterns that various presidents have set up. But Obama has determined that he's going to eat dinner five nights a week with his girls, and he has very strict boundaries about that. And on one hand, it's very lovely. On the other hand, he's also been criticized for it, and there's just no way to know what is absolutely right, and all one can do is think about the various issues involved.
Of course, it's early in the election season, middle of the election season, but do we know anything about Donald Trump as a father and also Hillary Clinton as a mother?
Yeah, I've actually studied them a lot in the last few months, and I've written a couple of pieces for Politico and other places, and I interviewed one of the Trump children, Eric. And I think this election is in some ways a rejection of Obama. I think that Americans really respect him as a father and are very moved by how connected he feels with his girls. At the same time, both Democrats and Republicans alike are a little frustrated with him. Democrats, because he hasn't done more to stand up to Republicans and hasn't gotten more legislation passed, and Republicans feel that he's a little too nice. Republicans feel that he's given away the store to Cuba or to Iran, and I guess both Trump and Hillary Clinton are back to the preoccupied. I mean, Hillary Clinton, she would be the first mom, but her parenting style is pretty male. It's not so nurturing. It's kind of like Franklin Roosevelt or LBJ. She's a very serious person. And the same with Donald Trump. And Donald Trump has always connected with his children through work. His three adult children and the three kids in their 30s are all vice presidents of the Trump Organization, just as Chelsea Clinton is the vice chair of the Clinton Foundation, whereas Obama, a more nurturing dad, would really encourage the daughter, he's encouraging his daughters to do whatever they want to do. And if it's not in politics, he would really be fine with it. Malia has expressed an interest in becoming a filmmaker. So I think both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are back to the preoccupied. And I think it has something to do with the frustration with Obama as a little too soft a leader from both sides of the aisle.
We leave it there. Joshua, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Joshua Kendall is a biographer and a journalist, and he joined us at the start of this Father's Day weekend to talk about the presidents and their very real roles as parents and what that says about their character. His new book is called First Dads, Parenting and Politics from George Washington to Barack Obama.
I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
One, two, three, go!